Good morning, family. It's good to see you, and I'm thankful that you're here, and for everyone that's joining us online, we send our greetings and our love to you online, and I bring to you greetings from the congregations in Homer and in Anchor Point, who got to fellowship with and teach last week, and I'm excited that our young adult group, a lot of them are in Seward this morning, ministering and serving our brothers and sisters down there, and it's very good for us to have fellowship together, whether it be online or in person. Our watering of each other and our service to each other, blessing one another, is very, very powerful and good and important. I think of years ago when most people had just, a paper Bible, and we would say, turn your Bibles, and you could hear the page turning together. It's a very comforting, familiar sound of everybody turning in their Bibles together in unity to learn together. There's like a new sound now whenever we're taking communion, of all the crackle of the cups, and we're together doing this, and we're a family, and there's certain family things that that get stuck in our minds, and in that mindset, we're going to continue with one of our fundamental teachings from Jesus as part of his family, going back to our roots of looking at Jesus's early teachings, these fundamentals of our beliefs, these things that our family is built on as Jesus being our rock. And for those that were not present, to recap where we're at in Jesus's Sermon on the Mount, so far he's talked to us about what does it mean to be blessed. And then in that blessed state, we're light to the world and salt of the earth. And then in our third session, we talked about how Jesus explains that he came to fulfill the law, and that this old covenant, this sacrificial system, is in place for him to fulfill it. And God's going to keep his promises. And then with all that in mind, that leads us now to our fourth session, our fourth part of this series, and this is where Jesus talks to us about anger, something none of us have a problem with today, of course, something that we've done away with. Now, anger is very much something we all wrestle with in different ways. Anger is an emotion and a chemical reaction to the opposition of our will. So when something goes the way that we don't want it to go, there is a reaction within us, and that reaction is anger. Anger has been something humanity has wrestled with basically since the beginning. Let's go back to Genesis chapter 4, verses 6 through 7. We see God talking to Cain. He says, "The Lord said to Cain, 'Why are you angry? And why has your face fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door, and its desire is contrary to you, but you must rule over it.'" So sin, we see, has been present, or anger in particular, has been present all the way back in right after the garden. And anger and murder have so much connection between the two, where anger is the seed and murder is the fruit, but they are of the same spirit. And Jesus is going to teach us, as Ben just read for us, that anger without cause and murder go hand in hand. But as we see here, just as God tells us, this anger does not need to rule over us. This sin that has a desire contrary to what God's will is does not need to be the master of us. And that anger, though a powerful emotion, does not need to dominate us. And we are capable of not giving into it, although it seems so persuasive. So before we get into the passage in Matthew, back in the Sermon on the Mount, I need to again remind us that the Gospel of Matthew has a very specific audience that it's written to. We have four different Gospels, all telling the same story, but from a different perspective and written to a different audience. The Gospel of John was written later in the century of the first century for like second or third generation of Christians for them to have sound theology. And the Gospel of Luke was written for Gentiles, for people that didn't have a Jewish background. Mark was written for people, for Roman citizens, most likely the people of the Roman Empire who were so focused on power, and Mark was written to demonstrate the power of Jesus. And then Matthew is written for Jews. And so there's a lot of Jewish symbolism and culture and references in this gospel. And in this Sermon on the Mount, Jesus is talking to Jews, and this is recorded in Matthew. So there's going to be some Jewish things we're going to be talking about today. So with that in mind, let's jump into this passage that's going to be our core scripture this morning. Matthew chapter 5, verse 21. You have heard that it was said of those of old, you shall not murder, and whoever murders will be liable to judgment. But I say to you. So this is a very important idea throughout Jesus' sermon on this mountainside, where he is quoting and referencing the law of Moses, where you have heard that it was said, and it was rightly said, you shall not murder. And he's referring back to the law of Moses, and which is law for the Jewish people. And you can see this contrast Jesus is now bringing into their mind and into the world, this idea of, but I say to you. And at the end of the sermon, we're going to see how the crowds were astonished because they said Jesus spoke with authority. And this is the authority he's talking with, where he's saying, the law said this, but I say this. And he is demonstrating he is the authority on these issues. And in reality, he's the author of this law that they received. And so here we start seeing this common theme where he's going to use this phrase often throughout this sermon. You have heard that it was said, but I say to you. And it's important for us to take note of this, that we see the authority of Jesus. He wasn't just a modern commentator of Mosaic law at that time. He was somebody very different. Nobody else was talking like this, of having the, and if you weren't looking for a Messiah, this would be such an audacious statement to say, you've heard the law say this, but I tell you this. This is a statement of great authority. Nobody had the power to talk like this, and the way Jesus is stepping into the limelight here. So let's get into now what he says as he talks about the spirit of the law, not just the letter of the law. He says that everyone who is angry with his brother is liable to judgment. Now your translation might have angry without cause, as some early manuscripts have that in there. And I think that is a good translation, as we're going to talk about that anger in itself is not sinful, but anger without cause, or anger that is not like God's anger, is sinful. And this idea of judgment in this Jewish context, this judgment was if you were to murder somebody, the community at time would gather and then give judgment, and you would be executed if you were a murderer. And we see here this, where Jesus is equating this anger with your brother without cause is as if you are murdering them spiritually. But something we're going to talk about a lot this morning is that anger in itself is not sinful. Ephesians 5:1 says we are to be imitators of God as beloved children. And we see God at times often getting angry about certain things. We'll talk more about that in a moment. So we see here Jesus is setting the standard that just the physical action of murdering somebody is not what Jesus, or not what God is looking to abstain from, but this anger without cause is what is equated to the severity of murder. He continues to raise the bar. He says, whoever insults his brother will be liable to the council. So he's increasing the severity of our, if we're mishandling our relationships with people around us. This word insult, as Ben read for us from New King James Version, that word is raka. And in that in that time, in that culture, it was this expression of bitter contempt, of considering somebody a worthless person. And that idea of just insulting somebody is not not what Jesus is talking about here. You know, if somebody says to me, "I think your shirt is dumb," you know, that could be insulting. That's not the spirit of this word. The word here of insulting somebody is considering that person worthless or with bitter contempt. Of course, this is a nice shirt, and if you thought it was dumb, you'd be wrong. But the idea, the spirit behind this passage is if the person, if you consider them worthless or with contempt, that is murderous. That is, as in God's eyes, just as evil as taking the life of someone. I don't like talking about politics up here, and for years I have avoided even learning about politics, yet politics in our culture seems to have been woven into everything now, and in the mind of trying to be all things to all people. The last year and a half, I've been trying to keep my ear to the ground, so to speak, of just understanding where people are coming from and just being more politically aware so that I can better talk to people in our culture where politics seems to be such a core perspective right now. And there's this debate and argument going around with many different people, this idea of hate speech, that your words can be abusive and hateful. And on just on a political level, and the concepts of free speech and what's good for our country is an interesting conversation, and definitely something that there's definitely honor in trying to be wise about. Here we see from Jesus's teachings that what we say about people matters. And just because we might be permitted as a country to say certain things on a spiritual level, there's things that can come out of our mouth that we are legally free to say, but spiritually are evil to utter. And that's something that as we try to tame our tongues in submission to God, just because we're free as citizens of this country to say certain things, do not mean that they are things we should say as God's people. And the idea of us talking about other people, it can be murderous. I don't know if murderous is really a word, but Annie keeps a list of words I make up, and I wonder if this is going to be added to them. But I like the word murderous, so we're going to use it today. So this idea of hate speech, this idea of things that we can say can be equated to murder because of what's going on in our heart. And I wasn't planning on sharing this with you, but I feel prompted to do so. Yesterday, Ethan and I and the three girls from our mission team were out meeting people in the community and looking to pray with them and to start Bible studies with them. And there was a young man that I met yesterday, and him and I don't think could be any more polar opposite. And he told me with his own words, literally, that he is a far left extremist, anarchist, and Satanist. And I can't think of anything more opposite than everything that I currently believe. And we talked together, and we are planning on getting coffee this next week and to study and talk about from the Bible, well, what is truth and is there truth? And I'm really looking forward to that conversation. But there was a temptation in him opening up and saying those things to want to consider him with contempt and to say, well, you are evil. You are everything that I am opposed to. But yet what I read in scripture is Jesus saying things like, love your enemies, and that we don't wrestle against flesh and blood, but against these spirits, against these evil powers, against these ideas. And this individual, who he's not here this morning, and I didn't want to share this with you because I was afraid of anybody I ever brought to church. You'd think, is he the Satanist guy? Like, so anybody I bring, where anyone comes with me, please don't show partiality if they're in their journey, and hopefully you'll get to meet him and pray that his heart will be receptive and he'll be good soil for the gospel to be planted in. So I won't say his name, but please be praying for this young person. But I'm not super old. I don't think. I got some more gray hair now, but I don't think I'm that old. But I'm old enough to remember hearing other people being talked about with contempt and with a worthlessness in people's hearts. I've right after 9/11, I remember people talking about Muslims with a type of bitterness and worthlessness. I remember different presidents and different political parties being spoken about with bitter contempt, and they were being insulted even though they're our brothers, as our fellow humans. And, you know, our neighborly Satanist over here, he might be my enemy, but he is also my brother. Our fellow man can be our enemy and our brother simultaneously, and it's capable for us to consider them with bitterness and with contempt. And that's this insult, this raka, where when we perceive people as worthless, we are killing them in God's eyes. And that is unacceptable if we're wanting to be this blessed people Jesus is talking about in this sermon. And then the consequences here is saying liable to council. And the council here that's referring to is the Sanhedrin. It's the highest council in Jewish culture. It'd be the equivalent of our Supreme Court. And so not only is this a type of murder, this is like a heinous, scandalous murder of not just hating somebody without cause, this is, or being angry to somebody without cause. This is now, if you're insulting your fellow man, if you're considering your fellow man worthless, Jesus is saying this is a scandalous, heinous, national headline level of crime. And he's increasing the severity of how we perceive our fellow man in this world. Jesus then raises it another level, turns up the notch all the way to 11 with this next part of this passage. He then says, and whoever says, you fool, will be liable to the hell of fire. This word, you fool, is moros, and it's where we get our word moron from. And it is the concept of senseless wickedness, where you're just clueless, you are animalistic, you have no faculties to make choice, and you're being a moron is literally what this word means. And the word fool is not taboo. It's not an unforgivable curse. The idea of foolishness, or even calling somebody fool, you know, behaving foolish. Jesus himself, in the same sermon, just a few chapters from now, Matthew chapter 26, he talks about the wise man and the foolish man who builds his house on the sands, the same word there. But there's a big difference, a massive difference between saying this person is a fool to saying this person is acting foolish. To say somebody is senseless versus saying they are acting as if they're senseless, it sounds like you're splitting hairs, but there's actually a huge distinction, because God honors our choices and we are capable of making choices, and we can choose to act foolish, but there's still a choice, and that choice is part of being made in the image of God, of being able to love, which is a choice. And people choosing to reject is so much different than saying they never had a choice to begin with and they're just being senseless. And so when we consider our fellow humans as if they had no choice and they're just animals, we're dehumanizing them. We are making them essentially animals, just acting purely on impulse without decision. And that's not to say there's no foolishness in the world, that we ourselves haven't, you know, made foolish choices, but the idea of that they are a fool, it's the difference of judging somebody's actions versus declaring their character. And so we are to, it's right to recognize the difference between wisdom and foolishness, but to say to a person that they have no choice, they're just morons, is an abusive and murderous spirit. That the consequences here, we see Jesus saying, is he says, hell of fire, or fire of hell, depending on how you look at it. And the idea of eternal damnation and this idea of hell being fire forever, there's a long history of how that image has been developed. And it goes back to the kings of Israel, where some of them had become quite rotten spiritually, in a sense, in their actions. And there was a valley near Jerusalem, just south of the city, where these kings would sacrifice children to the god Molech. And they became such abominations in their actions. And then when Josiah had this reformation of getting the kingdom back on track, he turned that valley where these horrible things were taking place, where they were burning these children, he turned it into a dump. He made it a place where all the garbage and refuse of the city and trash and sewage and corpses and animal carcasses would be dumped in this valley and lit on fire. And tradition has it that there was always a fire in this valley, and that way the place could never be used again for worship of these false gods. And then it was called then the Valley of Gehenna. And it was this place of constant burning outside the city. And if you were a convicted criminal to a certain degree of heinous crimes, you weren't buried, your dead body was thrown into this valley. And so there was no greater shame and disconnection from the people than to be judged and then tossed into this place. And God uses this imagery throughout the rest of the Old Testament, and then gets really utilized in the New Testament, this idea of God's judgment on evil. And the sacrifice of children is so in our face, grotesque and abhorrent and repulsive. And then we see here Jesus saying, considering your brother, that considering them a fool, gets right in the same place as the sacrifice as children. And it's for us to really kind of have an eye-opening moment of, man, how I treat people really matters. How I interact with the people around me is really, really important. And it's easy for us to compare ourselves to other people and be like, well, I'm not that bad. Like, I'm not sacrificing children. But am I viewing people around me as with contempt? Or am I viewing people around me as they're not making choices, they're just morons? That's something we're very tempted to do, and we have all struggled with in different ways, and some of us have stumbled with that. And this is why Jesus is teaching us, as the Sermon on the Mount covers a lot of topics, but it's not by chance that Jesus starts with these things, because these are like the fundamentals of the fundamentals of making sure that anger is not the fuel in which we act towards people. It's not the lens in which we look at people and the world around us. So how you see and treat other people is of the highest importance. And that's not an exaggeration, as Jesus then says, therefore, if you have it, everything that just he was talking about. So if you are offering your gift at the altar, and this is a Jewish thing with worshiping in the temple, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go. First be reconciled to your brother, and then come and offer your gift. So this is the Jewish practice of worshiping in the temple, and they would bring their sheep or their lamb or some other gifts depending on their economic status and also their spiritual, you know, experience recently, depending on what type of sin or what type of offering they're giving. And they would go, and there'd be a long line, and they would have their animal or other item that they would be offering to the priest and then to the temple. And the imagery here is you give your lamb to the priest, and they're going to go get it ready for you, and then you're going to have this offering in this time of worship, and this, whether it's sin offering or peace offering or other offerings. And the idea is so profound, where God's saying your relationship with your fellow man is more important than your relationship to me right now. And if this is not right, then this is not going to be right. And that's a repeated theme throughout the New Testament, where if you don't show mercy, you don't receive mercy. If you hate your brother, then you're a murderer. If you say to somebody, peace and be well fed, but then you don't share with them, what to be well fed, then you're missing it. And that if your love for your fellow man is absent, then you can't have a love for God. And so God's saying, don't worship me if you have wronged somebody. And this is it's like the other side of, if you don't show mercy, you won't receive mercy. This is where you have wronged somebody. If your brother has something against you, where you've done something wrong, you need to go and ask for mercy from your fellow man before you try to be asking mercy from God, which is a very profound and humbling concept to know, like, I need to go and make things right. And there's this conflict resolution wisdom that I think is very, very good, and that is you always take ownership and responsibility for your contribution to the problem. If there's conflict with you and somebody, and 95% of the problem is this other person, you own your 5%. And you express that. Now, don't tell them that you're only the 5%. I know you're 95% of the problem, but I'll share mine. Don't do it that way. If somebody has something against you, or you have dropped the ball on something, which we all do in all different ways, you own that. And what this passage is continually telling us is that the price of pride is too high. That if we can't humble ourselves and talk to people and say, please be merciful with me, I was not like God in this. If we don't have that attitude, that's going to disrupt our connection to God, to our worship to God. And this idea of looking to make things right with our fellow man is so fundamental to our walk with Jesus, and it cannot be disregarded. So if this is bad, then this is going to be bad. Jesus goes on to say, come to terms quickly with your accuser while you are going with him to court, lest your accuser hand you over to the judge and to the judge of the guard, and you be put in prison. Truly I say to you, you will never get out until you have paid the last penny. So coming to terms quickly, the spiritual ramifications of this is to own up, to humble yourself with those that have something against you. And again, we can't afford to have pride. The price is too high. And not only is it too high, we don't even have the currency to pay that one penny. Because that's what Jesus is talking about with being blessed earlier. Blessed are the poor in spirit. When we don't have anything to offer, there's no spiritual currency we can generate. It doesn't work. It doesn't work that way. We are spiritually broke in more ways than one. Not only do we have no spiritual currency, we're spiritually messed up without Jesus. And that's a real fundamental difference with just the teaching of Christianity, with Islam and with karma and many other teachings. You hope that your good deeds outweigh your bad. With Christianity, Jesus is offering up his good deeds to replace our own, and in spite of our own, because we got nothing to offer. But Jesus has everything to offer. And it's the substitution that then motivates us to live the way that we do. Not for us to achieve or for us to, you know, accomplish things through our actions, but for us to receive what was done for us. And then it's in that reception of what he's done that then motivates us to live like him, to follow him. And so in this idea of settling things with our accuser, our real accuser is, of course, Satan. And to settle things with him instead of us trying to pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps is instead falling to our knees before the throne and settling things with, I can't repay this debt, but I know someone who can, and his name is Jesus, and I am in need of him. And if I don't settle things by accepting Jesus, then there's no hope for me. I'm going to be locked up forever. And that's the implications of what Jesus is saying is, if you don't settle things, you're going to be locked up forever. Because we have all wronged somebody. We have all fallen short of the glory of God. We are all in need of getting bailed out, and we're all broke. And if we're going to get bailed out, then we need someone to settle things. And the only one who can settle things is the one who's saying this, is Jesus. You probably can't see it right now, but I have some spots on my hand because my communion cup had a hole in it. And as I was turning it sideways to rip open the top for the bread, there's the juice came out and stained my fingers. And I was looking at it, and at first I was like, oh, man, and it kind of got sticky. And then I was looking at it, and just, I'm a very visual person. Thanks, Mom, being an artist. And I had these stains on my hands now, and I thought about just the contrast of King David, where God says you can't build the temple because you have too much blood on your hands. And there was a separation. Even though he's a man after God's own heart, there was some barrier created because of the way David had interacted with people. And he had blood on his hands. And I was just looking at my hand, and I thought of just the symbolism and in some ways the irony of, here am I with blood on my hands, but it's Christ's blood on my hand. And because of that blood, I now have an access to God that is, there's no other way to have this type of access except through the blood of Jesus. And so in settling things with our accuser, it's only through that blood that we can have this settlement. And it's not by good that I've done. I didn't make this blood happen. This was a free gift that Christ brings into this world for us. And something that we can have settled. And that can then curb all this anger when you have Christ being the one who settled, because that blood is on my hands. He died because of me. And I am now able, and so are you, because of Christ, to not let anger be the dominating force in our life. It doesn't have to rule over us. And we're going to look now that there are things we're to be angry about, but we don't have to let that anger rule over us. And we're going to talk now about our accuser and how he is looking to have an opportunity in our life. Ephesians 4, 26 through 27, we're told to be angry, but do not sin. And do not let the sun go down upon your anger, and give no opportunity to the devil. So the reason we're looking at this now is that there are some things worthy of anger. But in that anger, we are not to miss the mark. That is, we're capable of being angry, but do not sin. And that there are some things worth being angry about. Again, anger is the opposition and the reaction to your will being opposed. And we're to be having not my will be done, but yours be done. We're to have God's will. And when there's opposition to that will, there should be anger. If it's for my will, not God's will, then that's the anger of man, and that does not produce good things. But in our anger, when God's will is opposed, we're not to miss the mark. We're capable of still hitting the mark even in that anger. And my point with that is that you and I are in control. Anger is not an excuse for our behavior. For example, I'm sure we've all experienced where we are in a heated argument with our spouse or a friend or family member, and there's just some yipping and yapping and snapping at each other. And somebody knocks on the door, or somebody calls you, and you open the door and you pick up the phone, and what's your attitude now like? Hey, how's it going? Yeah, things are going good here. Good to hear from you. How's the kids? And it's just like someone flipped a switch. Well, who flipped the switch? Well, you did. I did. And it shows that we have more control on this wheel that is the car of our life than we sometimes act. And that you are and I are capable of letting this tongue be tamed. We just tend to give in to these impulses instead of letting God give us self-control in our submission to Him. And I mentioned that you and I are more in control than we have been conditioned to think, that we just react to people around us instead of acting like Christ. And this concept is so important about being angry about the right things, but then not letting the sun go down upon your anger. That it's okay to have bursts of anger about the right things, but it's not okay to have perpetual, unresolved anger. And the reason why is the way we're designed, it's so interesting, and science is discovering more and more of this about what goes on in our minds. When we go to bed at night and when we're asleep, our minds are so active and our brains are filtering and processing our experiences of the day. And we remember things based off of our emotional intensity in that experience. And anger is very much an emotion. And when we have unresolved anger, our brain is taking the most impacting experiences and elevating them in importance. And when we have unresolved anger and we go to bed angry, our brain is taking that thing that causes anger, and it's prioritizing it, and it's making it a more prominent aspect of our character. And that anger becoming a more foundational part of our personality and character is how Satan then has an opportunity in our lives. Because the things that anger us tend to control us. And if Satan can cause us to be angry all the time about things that we should have resolved before, it is a collar around our necks that he can then lead us by into the direction he wants us to go. And that type of trap is really everywhere. We're surrounded by it. Our culture, our news, really our society is creating this outrage culture where we're supposed to be angry about everything, and we're supposed to be up in arms about everything, and it's just this constant state of being angry. And as Christians, as people, we are to resolve that anger before the night so that we do not be molded, we're not conformed to the world. We don't let the world shape us, because in the shaping of us, they then have opportunity and control over us. And that is Satan's scheme of to devour us, is for us to be in a constant state of anger towards those outside, to the system, to people far away that we've never met, or to people, just other people, instead of looking at what's actually going on in my heart. It's the same going all the way back to Cain and Abel, where God's saying, what's going on in here? Do you do well to be angry? Is this really what you want? If you do well, you'll be okay. There's something that's against you, that has a desire for you, but you can say no to it. You can say sit. You can say down. You don't have to jump on me and bite me. You don't have to be a part of me. And so you can let the sun go down, not on your anger. Your anger can be resolved. So don't let the world say jump and you hop up. Don't let the world own you. You can be free of it. But so don't go to bed angry, because in doing so, you're letting your accuser into your life. And our last passage today, our last scripture, is what I mentioned earlier with Ephesians 5:1, where we're told, therefore, be imitators of God as beloved children. We're to be angry about the things God gets angry about. We're to imitate him. And I love this picture because I saw this and I thought of Paul talking about imitate me as I imitate God or imitate Christ. And I see myself, I'm just this little kid. But I'm trying to be like my father. I'm trying to have his heart, his mind, his character, and not let the world tell me how to act and how to be and what to be angry about. I want to be imitating my father. My father gets angry about some things, and those are the things I want to get angry about. And I want to also have that slowness to anger he has, and that anger abates. It does not consistently remain. And I want that. I want the sun to go down on my anger, or I want the sun to go down when my anger has. I don't want my anger to outlast the sun. I'll say that. So let's be imitators of God. Jesus has shown us how to live. Let's re-examine how he lived so that we can follow him. And we go back to these fundamental teachings. We go back to these basics because this world is constantly squawking and teaching us and trying to influence us to behave in a certain way. And we're going to not just say no to that. We're going to say yes to Christ. We're going to look to him on how he lived. And we're going to see what he's angry about and seek to imitate that in the world around us. Our fellow brothers of humans are not our enemy. They are not our true opponents. And we can face our opponents, we can face our enemies with love and with grace and with patience, and they do not have to control us in how we react to them. We can act in love towards them. And so let's make sure that we have the heart of God in all that we do, and making sure that anger, which is such a worm that writhes into our hearts, that we check that we examine ourselves, and that we make sure that we have hearts like Christ and nothing else. So with that in mind, let's now stand and sing the next song that's been selected.